Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, October 4th, 2017. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, justice editor for Think Progress, author of Injustices, The Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted, Ian Millhiser will be here to give us a preview of this Supreme Court's term, including a rundown of the arguments in a really important gerrymandering case that had oral arguments yesterday in front of the court. Also on the program today, Trump goes full sociopath on Puerto Rico tour. Manafort's son-in-law turns. Ivanka and Jr. seem to have bopped their way out of a fraud indictment.
That's meanwhile, my kids.
The knives are out for Tillerson. Former Obama administration healthcare officials will fight Trump on Affordable Care Act signups. And a new study, without federal and state subsidies, 45% of oil production in this country at this price would be unprofitable. Meanwhile, an anti-choice congressman begs his mistress to get an abortion.
Please.
Paul Ryan, Mitch McConnell in gun rights expansion triage. And lastly, our Secretary of Education spends $6.5 million. $1 million on defense. Million. Did I say billion? $6.5 million a year on security. All that and more on today's program. Folks, sorry, we had a little false start there because there's something wrong with my microphone. Apparently, it's a little bit loose. Michael broke it last night.
Oh, of course.
And I should also tell you that I already have a correction to make about today's program. Earlier in this program today, I said that we are the four-time award-winning Majority Report, and I want to apologize. What I should have said is that we are the five-time award-winning Majority Report. That's right, folks. You folks and the voters. I'm not even quite clear on how it works. They have a different system over at podcastawards.com. We won our fifth Best News in Politics award from podcastawards.com. And that makes it, we are 5 for 5 out of the years that we were eligible for that award. 5 for 5. I think we're done now. I don't think we can win it anymore. I think we broke it.
It's called a perfect record, Puerto Rico.
Yeah, it's too bad Puerto Rico couldn't get it together and do something like that.
I wish they could win a podcast award.
We're the San Antonio Spurs of podcasts.
Wow.
Well, I mean, I think the Celts won a lot of
but the Spurs won 5.
Whatever.
In a certain
Listen,
sense.
Listen, folks, seriously, thank you. Thank you for the support. And it is, it's nice. I mean, it's nice to get acknowledged for your work in that way. And so we all here appreciate it. Everybody's going to get a chance to take the trophy home for a night. Take it out to a bar or whatever. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Matt.
Matt's
like,
wearing.
Yeah, it's nothing. That's just it's a little thing called trophy.
Yeah, sorry. Oh, excuse me. Let me just move that. Michael will drink his Chardonnay out of it.
Chablis.
Flip it over. Drink a Chablis.
Chablis.
You know.
You'll lord it over your children.
I will.
In an attempt to get some authority.
I definitely will. Excuse me, young lady. Do you realize I've won 5-time award-winning show? Now you get to bed. I'm sorry, folks. This week has just been insane. And I'm feeling a little punch drunk, I think. It's only fucking Wednesday. You know, when Michael goes out with that trophy and his Porsche Chablis in it to his local wine bar, he'll be looking for something. For some, like Michael that night, he'll be looking for a little attention. For others, it's for purpose.
That was the transition.
Unforgettable experiences. But for most of us, let's face it, it's our keys. Now, look, people ask me, why do I wear the same pair of pants every day?
Because you have weird phobias.
Now, no, you're absolutely wrong.
You're wrong.
You're wrong. You're wrong. I switched over. It's August 2nd the other day. I switched over from my shorts into my pants. And the reason why I do it is because I'm always, like, I have too many things going on and I can't think about, like, where's my wallet? Where's my keys? If my keys don't go in my pants, everything gets messed up. But I have a backup plan. Tracker Pixel, you will never worry about losing your things again. 8 years ago, Tracker, it's Track and then an R, changed everything when they released their first tracking device. Now they've done it again with the all-new Tracker Pixel. It's the lightest Bluetooth tracking device on the market. You place Tracker Pixel on whatever you tend to lose, keys, wallets. I don't know, you could put it on your animals, I guess. Then, when you misplace an item that has a Tracker Pixel attached, you use your smartphone and a 90 decibel alert will help you find it in seconds. It has powerful LED lights so you can see things in the dark, and it can help you find your phone even when it's silent. And this is the amazing part. Okay, it's Bluetooth, right? But because every tracker is part of the largest crowd locate network in the world, you can locate items from miles away. Sort of crowdsource it through Bluetooth. And thanks to Tracker's 30-day money-back guarantee, you truly have nothing to lose. You can go to thetracker.com. That's the word the, track, and then the letter R.com. Enter promo code MAJORITY. Get 20% off any order. That's tracker.com, promo code MAJORITY for 20% off. Ladies and gentlemen, this is going to allow me to change my pants. TheTracker.com, promo code MAJORITY. Now, in addition to maintaining the same clothes all the time so that I don't... The other thing is helping me right now get through this, because the amount of news, folks, is just insane. It's just insane. And so there are long-form magazine articles that I want to read. I don't have time to read them. I don't know how I'm going to get them. And the thing that's basically helping me right now is my texture app. I've talked about it a lot. You know about it. In 2 weeks, I'd make my trip to Vegas. Honestly, the thing I'm thinking about most right now, well, in addition to like how I'm going to win the crafts table, is that plane ride where I'm going to sit down with my iPad and go through all of these articles that I've set aside in texture. It has over 200 plus magazines available. Puts an endless supply of in-depth interviews, articles in the palm of your hand. It gives you daily recommendations, exclusive interactive features, and it's fully searchable. So you can mark what you like. This is the part that I like. You check out old issues. You view bonus video content. You create your own magazine from 200 plus magazines for the cost of basically one subscription. They got National Geographic, they got Fast Company, they got Rolling Stone, they got Wired, they got Family Handyman, they got New Yorker, New York. It's normally $9.99 a month, but if you sign up right now at texture.com/majority, you get a 14-day free trial. 14 days. Try Texture for free when you go to texture.com/majority. Texture.com/majority. Check it out, folks. Honestly, it's I don't know. I guess it's maybe a testament to my life, but I really do. Like, this is my big fantasy. Like, I'm going to have 3 hours to read anything I want.
I kind of get it now.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, you just wait, buddy. And here is, and this is also exciting. We're very close. We've been doing a several week long search, essentially, for new hires. Not necessarily to replace old Kelly, even though she's now moved into the slot of old Kelly. But, because she's still sort of like, she's still present Kelly, just not local present Kelly. I don't know how to. Virtual Kelly. She's virtual Kelly. And we did our job search on ZipRecruiter. And I'll tell you something. It was the smartest thing I feel like I've done in ages.
Perhaps ever.
Ask me this question. Do you know where to post your job to find the best candidates?
Do you know where to post?
No, I didn't. I had no idea. So I just did it on ZipRecruiter. And it went to 100 plus job sites with one click. I went on Glass Ceiling to look up something. That's where you find out like what pay scales are for different professions. Mm-hmm. I found our, I was looking in the radio thing and I found our ad.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Bender rated you, but never mind.
No, Bender did not rate me.
He did a very bad job.
ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them. 80% of employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site within one day. And there's no juggling emails, no calls to the office. Screen, rate, manage all the candidates in on the ZipRecruiter dashboard. It's been really a great experience. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes. This tiny, tiny one that we have here, and the massive one will become. Right now, my listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, for free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/majority. That's ZipRecruiter.com/majority. One more time. Try for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/majority. You know my watchwords. The best time to look for candidates is when you're not hiring. All right. Let's do this fairly quickly. This Donald Trump was in Puerto Rico. Yesterday. He was there for about 4 hours. They had to extend the trip because there's a strong sense that he is completely out of touch, and they wanted to make it look like he actually cared about people.
I wonder where that came from.
We have a lot of audio and video from his trip there that I think if you were like a daughter or a son of Donald Trump's and you were trying to get him committed, this is footage that you would submit to the court. And say, this guy is just not, he doesn't have a sense of where he is or what's
going on.
Your Honor,
look.
Yes. This is what we'd like to submit as evidence. But here is another moment where Donald Trump wings it and actually says something that would genuinely be good for Puerto Rico. And remember, well, listen to what he says in an interview with Geraldo Rivera. Puerto Rico, which has been under the thumb of vulture capitalists and hedge funders for years now. Here's Donald Trump.
We're going to work something out. We have to look at their whole debt structure. You know, they owe a lot of money to your friends on Wall Street, and we're going to have to wipe that out. That's going to have to be, you know, you can say goodbye to that. I don't know if it's Goldman Sachs, but whoever it is, you can wave goodbye to that. We have to do something about, because the debt was massive on the island. And
okay, so there you have it. Yeah. He's going to wipe out the debt. Now, there's a guy who knows how to wipe out debt. If anybody does, Donald Trump.
Just don't pay, guys.
This is what people have been asking for. This would be huge. It would be monumental. And it's undoubtedly not going to happen. Here's Mulk Mulvaney just hours later on with Chris Cuomo.
The president seemed to suggest that he is open to wiping out the Puerto Rican debt.
I got to just correct Chris Cuomo there. He didn't seem to suggest anything. He said, we're going to wipe it out. But okay.
Freaking debt. Is that to be taken seriously on its face?
I wouldn't take it word for word with that. I talked to the president about this at some length yesterday as we flew home on the on Air Force One. And what we're focusing on right now is what you and I just talked about, which is the primary focus of the federal effort is to make sure the island is safe and that we're rebuilding the island. Dealing with the challenges that Puerto Rico had, the island is at least $72 billion in debt, 120 if you go by other counts, before the storm. We are going to focus our attention right now on rebuilding the island, repairing the island, making sure everybody is safe and that we get through this difficult time.
Yeah, in other words, oh, he's crazy. And we're not going to do that. So
sometimes inadvertently he advocates for things that might genuinely benefit people. So then I got to pull him aside in the plane right. And explain.
Exactly.
There's no way that we're going to try to alleviate the suffering of the PRs.
Yes.
We're kind of on the opposite agenda. We're trying to create more suffering in the world.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, Bannon texted me, told me to say that. And then I said it. And that's all we really need anyways. We just need it to be said.
Just say
and then,
things.
Then we'll let, okay, nobody's going to pay attention to Puerto Rico anymore anyways. Okay, that's great. All right.
I was so confused why Steve would want to do that. It took me a long time for him to explain that they weren't Mexicans.
Right. All right, we got to take a quick break. When we come back, Ian Millhiser. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program Ian Millhiser. He is the Justice Editor for Think Progress and author of Injustices, the Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted. Welcome back to the program, Ian.
It's good to be here. Thanks so much.
All right, let's start with Gil v. Whitford. This is the... there are multiple sort of, I guess, like incredibly important cases in terms of what it will do to our politics and to our society that will come up in this term. And this is the this is obviously the first term of the Supreme Court with Neil Gorsuch sitting on the court, sitting in a seat that was really meant to be Merrick Garland's or someone else's.
Right.
This is the balance of the court has switched back to the conservatives. And this is going to be relevant when we look at cases that are more or less being revisited, not the exact same cases, but the same legal questions. But let's start with Gil v. Whitford. What is this case about?
Sure. I mean, Gil, it's not an exaggeration. Not only is this the most important case of the term, but it's probably the most important case we've seen in several years. Gil is an attack on partisan gerrymandering. And it was very clear several justices made comments. Paul Smith, the voting rights attorney, arguing the case against gerrymandering, made several comments about how gerrymandering is just getting more and more sophisticated. We're getting better data analysis tools, better computers, and we are entering a downward spiral where the party that controls the legislature when the maps are drawn can lock themselves into power so that they'll control the legislature again when the next round of maps are drawn, and you no longer have competitive elections.
In fact, so that's the Smith cited. And there's some data, I mean, specific data that I guess like in Wisconsin, they redrew the maps in 2011. And the next year, the Republicans won 48.6 of the vote in that state in Wisconsin, but they won 60 out of 99 assembly seats.
Right.
So,
they actually lost the popular election that year and still won the legislature because of the gerrymander.
Not even just won the legislature in like what you would call a landslide, right? I mean,
right. Yeah. I mean, yeah, it was, yeah, over 60% of the seats when they lost the election. This was an extraordinary gerrymander. And so the question here is whether this gerrymander violates the Constitution.
And let's just explain for a moment, just to back up for people who don't understand how that works. Like, I mean, there, you know, I think like mm-hmm. for the uninitiated, and we've talked about this on this program multiple times. We had an interview with the author of Rat Eft, which mm-hmm. talked about this. But just broadly speaking, explain how it is that you can lose the popular vote in a state, but still
right.
win the election that many seats.
Right. So there's basically two ways that people draw gerrymandered maps. In Wisconsin, they did both. One is called packing. So packing is, you know, let's say that you have a district that's already a solid Democratic district. Maybe 60% of the voters in that district consistently vote for the Democrat. Packing is when you just pack in a bunch more Democrats and turn a 60% Democrat district into, say, a 90 or 95% district. And what you do by packing is you cause all those Democrats you pack into it to waste their vote because, you know, they're going to be voting for someone who's already going to win anyway. The other thing that you do is called cracking. So cracking is, let's say you have a district that's narrowly Democrat, that's maybe 55% Democrat, where you'd expect the Democratic candidate to win most of the time. Cracking means you crack off a little sliver of those Democrats, put them somewhere else in a Republican district, and then fill in the voters you cracked off with more Republicans. So a 55% Democrat district becomes maybe a 45% Democrat district, and then the Democratic right. candidate is going to lose. And so that's what they did over and over and over again when they drew this map, is they look for opportunities to turn Democratic districts into Republican districts through cracking, and where there were too many Democrats living in one place to prevent a Democrat from getting elected, they just packed a whole bunch more Democrats in, so a whole lot of votes a whole lot of Democratic votes would be wasted. And that's what they accomplished here. That's how they got this map where Republicans could lose the popular election, still get more than 60% of the seats.
Okay, so that's the situation, and so outline, what is the argument made by Paul Smith, who was arguing for right. the plaintiff, saying that this was essentially anti-democratic? What's the argument?
Well, so here's the interesting thing. There really isn't any dispute that this violates the Constitution. I mean, some people have argued that it violates the First Amendment because you're discriminating against certain voters based on their viewpoint. Some people argue that it violates the Equal Protection Clause because you're treating voters who belong to one party better than voters who belong to the other party. But there really isn't that much disagreement over whether or not this violates the Constitution. And I don't think anyone really made an argument that it's okay to do this. What the court has said is, look, figuring out which maps are gerrymanders is really hard. Like, I mean, this is an easy case because the map is so egregious. But like, you know, if a state has 46% Democrats and they get 44% of the vote, is that a gerrymander? You know, what if they get 40% or 40% of the seats? What if they get 55% of the seats? Like, it's sometimes hard to draw these lines. What's interesting about this case is that the plaintiffs have come up with a number of mathematical formulas that can be used, and you run the map through these formulas and they will tell you if this map is very likely to be a gerrymander or not. So they've answered this question, how do we sort out the bad maps? You know, they found analytic, rigorous, objective ways to do that. And the question is whether there are five justices on the court who will say, okay, you've answered the how do we measure gerrymanders problem. Now we're going to go ahead and force what pretty much everyone, except for, I guess, Gorsuch. Gorsuch was the one guy yesterday who said that he thought that gerrymanders maybe don't violate the Constitution.
I want to get into that in a minute. Right.
Yeah, but besides Gorsuch, literally everyone seems to think this is unconstitutional. The question is whether or not there's a way that courts can go through and figure out which maps are in fact gerrymandered.
Right. So this is sort of like the problem was you don't know it necessarily when you see it. To put it in the context of pornography, I guess. So there's a couple of different ways of measuring this, but Kennedy was one of the justices who specifically cited the lack of a mechanism to determine this, right? I mean, that was always right. Supposedly his big stumbling block.
Right, yes. Yeah. So in 2004, the four most conservative justices, four of the conservative justices in 2004 said that we're just not going to get involved in the gerrymandering business at all. It's too hard. And Kennedy wrote a separate opinion where he said, you know, this is pretty hard and no one showed me a way to do it now. But if somewhere along the way people figured out a way to measure what it is and is not a gerrymander, I'd be willing to consider striking down gerrymandered maps.
And that's in Vith v. Jubliner, right? Or Jubliner?
Yeah, Vith v. Jubliner. It's two completely unpronounceable names. Vith, I believe, is the name of the first party. So Justice Kennedy says this in 2004, and then that sort of spawned this entire new field of political science, where for the last 13 years, there's been a lot of really smart people trying to meet Kennedy's challenge and trying to say, like, okay, like Kennedy has said, if we can show him an objective, solid, you know, way that courts can use to sort gerrymanders from maps that aren't gerrymanders, he will start striking them down. And people actually came up with three different methods that can be used, all of which came up in this case. This Wisconsin map, any one of the three methods determines that it's an egregious gerrymander. And so this is the question. Is after 13 years of work on this puzzle that Justice Kennedy gave the nation, after 13 years of people trying to say, okay, what is a way we can do to sort through the maps? Is Kennedy going to say, okay, like you have done what I have asked you to do, and now I'm going to give you what I have said I would give you, or is he still going to hem and haw?
Well, I mean, that's what's sort of amazing about this, right? Is because the implications of him saying, like, there has to be a way to do this, and it's, you know, he wasn't anticipating that someone would come down from the sky and divine it, that it would, I guess, come from social sciences. This puts a lot of pressure on him, it seems to me, to sort of accept it, I guess, if they can understand the math. And that became an issue, right? My understanding is there were three different sort of stabs at this. Tell us what they were and how the justices reacted to it.
Sure. So, I mean, you know, there's some complexity to all of the methods. One of the methods counts the number of wasted votes. So, like, counts the number of votes through cracking and packing that are either cast for a Democrat who would have won anyway or for a Democrat who lost, and then does the same for a Republican candidate. And if there's an imbalance in those wasted votes, then that tends to show a gerrymander. If there's a large imbalance, that shows it could be an egregious gerrymander. Another method looks at if you had a 50-50 state. So if you assume that in this election, you know, 50% of people vote for Democrats, 50% of people vote for Republicans. It tries to extrapolate what sort of legislature you'd wind up with. There's a third method as well. So, like, they've come up with these different mathematical models. Chief Justice Roberts, was very hostile to the notion that judges should have to do math. He had this whole rant about how well, we're going to look partisan if we rule in favor of Democrats. And then the only explanation we're able to give is a mathematical formula that people may not understand, which is an interesting thing for the guy who wrote the opinion striking down the Voting Rights Act to suddenly say that, oh, we might look partisan if we start striking down election laws. But anyway, I think that there was a sense amongst the conservatives, and I don't know if it was disingenuous or not, that math is not a thing that judges should be doing. Judges just shouldn't be in the business of, like, using formulas derived by social scientists. You know, Gorsuch had this rant about, like, that's not something that's in the Constitution. And I think Kennedy... Oh, go ahead.
No, you go ahead. Please finish, and then we'll get to that.
I think Kennedy at least seemed open to doing it. I mean, the most interesting thing about the argument is that Kennedy asked no questions at all of Paul Smith, the voting rights attorney. And at one point, he got really angry at one of the lawyers who was defending the maps because she wasn't answering one of his questions. So normally with Kennedy, when, like, he gets a little testy towards an attorney, that's often a sign that lawyer is about to lose.
Right. Okay, good. And all right. So I want to get to the Gorsuch thing in a second, but the question then becomes, like, how broad this ruling will be, right? I mean, is it like, right, okay, Wisconsin was so egregious that, I mean, this, yeah, so egregious that, okay, yeah, all three of these methodologies were probably right because it was like, you know, hitting a barn from 5 feet away. What happens right when that barn is 75 yards away, 150 right yards away, whatever it is? So
right,
that becomes the big question, right? Because or does it? I mean, or does this question have to be answered each time?
Right. So, I mean, I think what the justices are looking for, I mean, Justice Kagan, who's, you know, one of the liberals, brought this up several times, is I think they're looking for a way to sort out the most egregious gerrymanders without causing the courts to have to intervene in every case. And for what it's worth, if you sort out the most egregious gerrymanders, that does a lot of work. I mean, you, for one, you know, in Parker, you just have a ton of really bad gerrymanders right now. I mean, in Ohio, when President Obama won it in 2012, Republicans got 3/4 of the seat of the congressional seats. That's an egregious gerrymander. You know, you have very similar lopsided gerrymanders at the congressional level in Michigan and Wisconsin and Virginia and Florida and Pennsylvania. So if you just get rid of the worst of the worst gerrymanders in states like those, you do a whole lot of work. You know, and the other thing to keep in mind is that, you know, things do change over time. People move, you know, people get different ideas of who they may like. And so, like, in order for a gerrymander to have sticking power, it's pretty easy to draw a map that will determine what the next election will look like. But the problem we're seeing with these maps that are being drawn now is they're able to draw a map that rigs the next 5 elections. And if you rig the next 5 elections, after the 5th election, you've got to do your redistricting again. And so you just re-rig things.
Right.
And so if we can get to the point where we break that cycle, I mean, it might be difficult to prevent the party in power from rigging the next election, but if we can break this cycle where they're able to hold power until the next redistricting cycle and then use their control in the redistricting cycle, continue the cycle over and over and over so they control the legislature on and on unto infinity, that's going to do a whole lot of good.
Well, I mean, there's no way for the court to create a mechanism, right? I mean, you would need a legislative fix in terms of, like, some type of preclearance or. I mean, there's no way to really do this, is there? I mean, it just.
There are a number of problems here. I mean, one problem is that, I mean, problems that are just very difficult to fix. I mean, one problem is that sometimes you actually have to run an election under a map to know how bad the gerrymander is.
Right.
And so, you know, you might need to run one election just to gather the data you need in order to prove to a court that the map needs to be struck down. So that's one problem. Another problem is that lawsuits take a long time. And so, like, we see this over and over again in racial gerrymandering cases. You know, there's a case that's on its way up to the Supreme Court alleging a racial gerrymander in Texas. Texas ran four elections under this map that a lower, or they ran three elections under this map that the lower court said was an illegal racial gerrymander, and the Supreme Court just stayed that decision. So Texas is going to get to run a fourth election,
right,
under this map, which a court has said. So, like, there are a lot of problems that what you would want is something like the Voting Rights Act, where Congress steps in and you try to cut these things off at the pass. But all of that said, you know, the nightmare scenario, what we are headed towards right now, is a world where you have infinite one-party government, because if you can draw a map and hold it until the next redistricting cycle, you can control the government forever.
Right. And so what in this event, would it just revert to the existing, to the prior maps? Or would they have to redraw them?
Most likely what happens is they'd have to redraw them. And what happens in racial gerrymandering cases is most of the time they give the legislature a first crack at trying to draw maps that aren't unconstitutional, and then the courts may dicker around with them.
So in other words, the court could say, we're going to send this back down to the circuit court. The circuit court is going to come up with a mechanism to make sure that you fix this. So you're going to have to redraw the maps and then submit it to the judge who is going to theoretically apply these tests, these models, and get a sense as whether or not it's within 4 to 5% or something.
Right. Yeah, I mean, and that's correct. I mean, the problem is, and this is why, until we get some real legislation dealing with, I think that you're going to continue to see gerrymandered maps, is it takes so long,
right,
to go through the litigation process. And I mean, if you're a lawmaker who wants to protect your own seat, and you draw a map and you hope it's going to protect your seat forever, but it only protects it for the next two elections, that's still two elections you don't have to worry about, so you're still going to do it.
Yeah. You can only, I guess, break this cycle. It's nice that, you know, we have some type of at least an open door from the court, or we might get one. But it's going to need some type of legislative fix, I think, down the road. All right. Well, let me just ask you about this then. Gorsuch, he comes off. There was a piece by Jeffrey Toobin about an exchange between Gorsuch and Ginsburg.
Yeah.
Gorsuch comes off. He starts off his question by saying, maybe we can just for a second talk about the arcane matter of the Constitution. Being somewhat sarcastic, implying that the Supreme Court justices are not thinking about the Constitution in some way, which is just like, I don't know how to articulate this other than to say, like, he just sounds like a dick. I mean, honestly, like, I don't know how else to express that.
Dick is a good word to describe Judge Gorsuch.
And so he goes on to say that the court has no authority to deal with lines drawn by a state legislature. And then Ginsburg mumbles more or less to the fact, or I don't know if she mumbled or grumbled. Where did one person, one vote come from? In other words, saying,
right,
hey, where did we get that concept from? If those words aren't written in the Constitution, is that basically what went on there?
I think that's all right. I mean, like, the first thing is that Gorsuch is such a smug prick. I mean, and this goes back, like, I mean, during his confirmation hearing, a lot of Democrats, my understanding from, you know, just my Capitol Hill sources, there are a decent number of Democratic senators who decided to vote against him, not because they like necessarily came into the confirmation fight wanting to cast a no vote, but because they found him to be such a jerk. He routinely lectures his colleagues, all of whom have been there longer than him, on like how they should be doing their job. He at his hearing, there's this, you know, if you watch a lot of confirmation hearings, there's this sort of like ritualized obsequiousness that every nominee has where, you know, thank you, Senator. I appreciate the question, Senator. If I have the honor of being confirmed, you know, they go out of their way to appear humble. And he couldn't even pretend to be humble for a few days. I mean, he is that guy. You know, he is the most obnoxious coworker you have ever had. He is the frat boy who felt entitled to everything that we all went to college with. That's who Neil Gorsuch is. And what was flabbergasting about this exchange, I mean, there's lots of things that are flabbergasting about it. I mean, it's that if you take what he said seriously, and he actually thinks that the Constitution has nothing at all to say about redistricting, that means that all of the racial gerrymandering cases are wrong. That means that the one person, one vote case, as Ginsburg pointed out, was wrongly decided. You know, no justice goes that far. You know, not even Justice Thomas goes that far. And, you know, on top of that, you know, if you read the whole exchange, it sounded like part of what he was trying to do was to trick Paul Smith, the voting rights lawyer, into going down a road that would lead to him saying that these aren't cases, these are things that have been resolved by Congress and not by the courts. And I mean, and the thing I'll say about that is that Paul Smith is one of the smartest attorneys on the planet. You know, Paul Smith, he was when he was in private practice, he was the Democratic Party's go-to guy for major redistricting cases before the Supreme Court. He also argued and won Lawrence v. Texas, the major gay rights decision. He did a lot of really interesting telecom work. Super, super. You're not going to trick Paul Smith. And the idea that Gorsuch thought he was so smart that he could trick Paul Smith, I mean, it just fits with everything else he's done. All the time he spends lecturing his colleagues. You know, I feel bad for the eight justices who, you know, we've all had an obnoxious coworker show up.
Oh, believe me.
And he is the worst. I feel bad for all of them. I even feel bad for Alito. Well, that they have to tolerate this guy.
Well, and that's probably helpful on some level, right? When we have like a guy like Kennedy there who you would anything that in any way alienates him from those four, it seems to me, is a positive. All right, so let me just ask you this one question, then we'll just go quickly. We'll just take a couple of minutes to go through the big cases that people should be aware of, and then we will end up discussing those as they come. But tomorrow on this program, I'm going to run an interview I did with Lawrence Lessig about a case that he is basically trying to get off the ground with a plaintiff in a Republican voter in a blue state and a Democratic voter in a red state. David Boies has said that he will take this case. I don't know if on that level, but on a Supreme Court level, where they are attempting to use the principle of one person, one vote to say that the way that states allocate their electoral votes by doing winner take all is denying essentially equal protection under that one person, one vote doctrine. Was there anything that came up in this case that could possibly implicate that one? I mean, it's clear Gorsuch doesn't necessarily believe in that concept. But it seems to me that on some level it was affirmed by, you know, that theory was affirmed by a majority of justices. I don't know if it will in that court. I'm just curious.
Yeah, I mean, I'm vaguely familiar with Lessig's theory, and I'm frankly a little skeptical of it. But like, I mean, to answer your question, I don't think anything that was said in yesterday's argument that really implicates it. And the reason why is it was such an unusual argument. I mean, normally when the justices hear a constitutional case, the question is, does this thing violate the Constitution? And like I said, with the exception of Gorsuch, no one really made the case or, you know, seemed to be making the case that partisan gerrymandering is constitutional. The argument was all about, like, is there a way that courts can figure out which maps are gerrymandered in a way that is accurate enough that they can actually start striking down these unconstitutional maps?
Right. And is there a bar that's been set as to, like, how gerrymandered something is before it becomes unconstitutional? Like, obviously, the act of gerrymandering is, it could be like we have a 0.02% efficiency gap versus a 23% efficiency gap. I mean, where's that line, or is that not drawn either?
Yeah, I mean, that's what this case needs to decide. And I mean, eventually the court is going to have to draw some kind of line like that. You know, it's what happened in the one person, one vote cases. So one person, one vote is the theory that all of your congressional districts and all of your state legislative districts have to be roughly the same number of people. Because you used to have this problem where you had states where, like, in the rural district, each rural voter essentially had four times as much representation because they had so many fewer voters in their district than in urban districts. And so now, you know, the number of districts has to be roughly the same. And the way that the Supreme Court has put meat on those bones is they've said that basically you get a 10% play in the joints. The Supreme Court will generally presume that districts are okay if there's only a 10% variation between the highest population district and the lowest population district. And so I suspect you'll see something similar emerge from the court where they'll say, look, like, so long as your map isn't within this range, like, so long as it only tends to advantage one party or another, you know, this relatively small amount, we're going to presume it's fine because drawing an absolutely perfect map is very, very difficult. But if you get more aggressive than that, and if you cross a certain threshold, then we're going to give it a very, very hard look, and you better have a really good explanation for why it turned out the way it did.
Okay, great. All right. Well, then I guess it just remains to be seen just how sold Anthony Kennedy was that his ask 15 years ago, more or less, was answered. And I guess we will know that probably closer to the spring, right?
Yeah, probably in June. This will probably be one of the cases that they hold on to for a really long time.
Okay. So let's talk about just some of the other big ones that are going to be coming up in this term. Obviously, Neil Gorsuch is, there's going to be a lot of preening, I think, from this guy. But there's another voting rights case that's coming up, Husted v. Philip Randolph Institute. Is that an tell us about that one briefly.
I mean, this is an important case. I mean, it's not as important as the gerrymandering case. This is a voter purge case, where, like, you have this practice in Ohio where what they want to do is they want to be able to send you a letter saying, hey, like, you haven't voted in a while. If we don't hear from you soon, we're going to strip away your right to vote. Or we're not going to strip away your right. We're going to deregister you so that you have to re-register again if you want to vote. And then, like, sometime later, if they don't hear back from you, they will, in fact, pull you off of the rolls. And there's a very complicated and not especially clearly drafted statute, which deals with these purges. And, there are some judges who have said that they think that these purges are allowed, some that think that they aren't allowed. Unfortunately, I think that the fact that the Supreme Court took this case, where the court below said that they are not allowed, is that there's probably five justices ready to reverse and they're going to allow these purges. And that's not great. I mean, it's not an earthquake. I don't think it's going to cause as much damage to our elections as, say, voter ID does. But, you know, the strategy from a lot of conservative policymakers is you chip away, you knock a few thousand voters off the rolls here, you prevent a few thousand over there from voting, you make it a little harder to vote over there. And after a while, you add up to enough people who aren't able to cast a ballot that a bunch of races that would have gone to Democrats wind up going to Republicans.
Right. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, argument that the things like cross check and whatnot like that have disenfranchised tens of thousands of voters, if not more.
Right.
All right. Well, let's talk about we have some labor cases. I mean, obviously,
yeah.
Janice V. AFSCME, we've already mentioned on this show, but why don't you just do a roundup of it? This is basically Friedrich's redux.
Right. Yes. So right before Scalia died, the court, as you mentioned, heard a case called Friedrich's. Friedrich seeks to defund a lot of public sector unions. The idea is that if you're in a unionized workplace, you do not have to join the union to get the benefits of being in the union. So like all the higher wages that unionized workers try to get, all the better benefits, you get all of those too, regardless of whether or not you join. And so what a lot of union contracts say is, you know, if you don't want to join, that's your right, but you do need to reimburse us your fair share of the cost of bargaining on your behalf. Because if people don't have to reimburse the union, what happens is that the union is starved for funds, and then no one gets any of the benefits of being in the union because the union collapses. This case seeks to eliminate these. They're sometimes called agency fees. This isn't called fair share fees. These fees that are charged to non-union members that they pay their fair share of the bargaining process. It seeks to eliminate them entirely in the context of public sector unions. And in the very likely event that the Supreme Court strikes down these agency fees, you're going to see a lot of unions go under, and you're going to see a lot of unions shrink.
Let's talk about arbitration too. This is another big one. We've seen the Supreme Court rule that you cannot have class action cases in terms of arbitration when it comes to things like AT&T overcharging people $3 a bill across an entire state, which is just absurd. But tell us about the one in regards to labor.
Sure. So this case, this was argued on Monday. It's a group of three cases, and it deals with this expansion of forced arbitration clauses that has really been going on for the last 30 years or so. So the history here is in 1925, the Supreme Court handed down, the Congress passed a law called the Federal Arbitration Act. And what the FAA was supposed to do is it was supposed to allow sophisticated merchants to say, you know what, if we have a dispute with each other, we don't want to deal with litigation. We'll just hire an arbitrator, and whatever the arbitrator says, we'll agree to be bound by it. And that's fine. Like if two people who are sophisticated or two companies that are sophisticated with eyes open want to do that, great. But beginning in the 1980s, the Supreme Court started to expand this arbitration so that companies could say to their consumers and eventually to their workers, hey, if you want to do business with us, you want to buy a cell phone, you want to have a bank account, you want to put your mother in a nursing home, or you want to work for us, you have to agree to forced arbitration. You can't go to a real court. You got to go to an arbitrator. And there's all kinds of data showing that the arbitrators tend to be more favorable to the companies than they are to the individuals. There's a lot of reasons for this. One of them is the fact that the companies tend to know who the good arbitrator or the arbitrators are that they want, and individuals don't. And so the arbitration winds up being very favorable. This case layers an additional layer on top of it. It says that in addition to having to go to an arbitrator, you can't bring a class action. A class action is when many people join together under a single lawsuit. And what they are mostly useful for is when you have a bunch of people who are cheated out of a little bit of money. So if a company cheats thousands of its workers out of a few hundred dollars in wages, none of them are going to sue individually because the cost of litigating that case is going to be more than a few hundred bucks. But if they can join in a class action, then it's one big suit. You can get one attorney to represent all of them. It's super easy. This case wants to cut off those class actions. And what you're going to get if you don't have class actions is a lot of wage theft.
All right. And lastly, we have a RFRA case as well, right? This involves the baker.
Oh, this is the cake baker. Yeah, this isn't a RFRA case. A RFRA is a federal law dealing with religious freedom. This is a constitutional case.
Okay.
So the issue here is that you have this baker who doesn't want to serve a same-sex couple because, you know, that's what he thinks God doesn't want him to do. And he, you know, so he discriminated against the same-sex couple. And now he's claiming that he has a constitutional right to not follow his state's anti-discrimination law, both because he has a religious objection to it, and also because he claims that he is an artist and he makes cake art. And as a cake artist, you cannot force him to make art for someone, you know, that expresses a message that he doesn't want to express, because that would be a violation of his free speech rights. And so basically what the
I get the sense that you're a little skeptical of cake art, Ian.
I am skeptical of this legal theory. And the reason why I'm skeptical of this legal theory is because I don't think I don't think you can draw a line to limit it. I mean, one of the, you know, two of the most seminal civil rights cases from the 1960s involving the ban on whites-only lunch counters involved barbecue restaurants. And I am from the South. Like, barbecue is something we take seriously down there. And I mean, people who make good barbecue are artists. But does that mean that, like, if I have a barbecue restaurant and I don't want to follow the law that says that I have to serve black people, that I can claim, oh, well, I am an artist and therefore the law doesn't apply to me? So I think that it's going to be very hard for the Supreme Court to draw a box around this rule. And I think that courts are going to find they're not very good at sorting out what kind of work is artistic and what kind of work is not artistic. But, you know, the real question here is
that what it's going to come down to, as to whether or not they have the ability to say that this is art? I mean, is that really going to be what it comes down to? Because obviously, like, there is a line, right? I imagine if the guy came and said, like, well, I'm a painter and I've been commissioned, you know, they came to me as, wouldn't the question be more about, like, you have a store that's open to the public, right?
Right.
It's not personal services that you're selling. You're selling cakes. This is a commercial entity. You have a storefront. I mean, those seem to be the ones that they could make that determination, no?
Well, so here's what I think is the right rule. And oddly enough, this is the rule that the Trump administration proposed in its brief. They just didn't use their own rule correctly. So I think the rule should just be, like, if there's a law that effectively requires me to make some kind of work of art, and you would think by me making this that it is me saying whatever message this art is supposed to convey. So, like, you know, if there is a law that, like, you know, forces me to paint a painting that says Donald Trump, that conveys the message that Donald Trump is awesome, and, you know, you would think that was my message and not the person who hired me to make the painting, then I think that crosses a line. But, you know, I mean, this guy's a baker. I mean, when you buy a cake from a baker, no one thinks that, like, by selling you a cake, this baker is endorsing your marriage. You know, I mean, I think back to my own wedding, and, like, I would have been creeped out. I mean, like, we hired this lovely pastry chef to make this spread of desserts, and they were wonderful. And I would have been creeped out if I found out that this woman, like, looked at me and looked at my wife and judged our marriage to be morally good enough that she was willing to make a sticky toffee pudding cake for us. No, like, you know, the fact that she made cakes for my wedding conveys the message that she is in the business of baking cakes, and that's it.
You know, I'm going to have to revisit what I've been telling my 4-year-old son on his birthday with the cupcakes, because we present him the cupcakes and we say, see, the bakery loves you.
Well, you know, maybe this anti-gay cake baker should win then. But no, I mean,
it's going to break his heart. It's going to break his little heart when he finds out that the cupcake maker just makes cupcakes.
That's amazing. Yeah, no, but I mean, I just think when you hire a vendor, like, you know, the message that the vendor is saying by being your client or by taking you on as a client is that I take clients to do this sort of work. Right. That's it.
Right. All right. Well, fair enough. Is there anything else you think that we should be watching out for in this term?
Well, the one thing looming over this term is the Muslim ban, which they were going to hear an oral argument on next week. Trump announced that he's going to change the ban, and now the court asked for briefing on whether or not the case is moot. I think, you know, regardless of whether it's moot or it needs to be what's called remanded to a lower court, I think the responsible thing would be for the Supreme Court to kick it back down to the lower court somehow, because the Supreme Court of the United States, the court of last resort, shouldn't be the first one to look at a brand new policy. We should let other judges look at it first. But one way or another, the legality of, you know, this now many times changed Muslim ban is going to have to be resolved, and probably resolved by the Supreme Court of the United States.
Right. All right. Well, Ian Millhiser, thank you so much for this rundown of what we can expect in this term, or at least what we know they're going to be looking at. Really appreciate it. And we will have you back as these courts are heard and we get a better sense of where where the justices stand, to the extent that we can divine from the oral arguments. Thank you so much.
All right. Sounds great. Thanks, Sam.
Ian Millhiser, Justice Editor of Think Progress, author of Injustices, Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted. Thanks again, Ian. All right, folks. Going to take a quick break and head into the fun half. There is a chance we're going to have a surprise guest on in the fun half. And if it does happen, we'll see. But
David Dane does not count as a surprise guest, Sam, no, just to be clear.
No, David Dane does not.
Okay.
I mean, when he calls in, surprise, it's a surprise. I did, like I said, I got a call earlier from Washington, D.C. during the break. I didn't take it. I just thought, it's just another person from Washington calling me.
I thought you thought it was one of those cruise pyramid schemes.
That's
that
exactly.
You get called with all the time. I have never seen anybody get more like, congratulations, would you like to fly? I don't know why I do Lindsey Graham. How great would that be if Lindsey Graham moonlighted
operator? Thing is, they're not real people. They're always recordings of people that make them
sound like they're people. You take the process so you get to a real person.
Yes, and I do take it that far.
You go, thank you very much. And they go, all right, sir. There is actually some room over on that first class yacht that we're charting out over there to the Bahamas. And I'm just going to need your social security number and a blood sample in the mail.
He will be calling in at, I believe, around 1:45. If we do get that call, he is a senator from the state of Vermont.
Patrick Leahy.
I've never talked to Patrick Leahy. I don't know why he would call me. But
he's getting stoked.
We'll see. I don't know. He landed Leahy, finally.
Leahy. Leahy was in a Batman movie.
I know that.
Yeah.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we will have some fun half for you. We have all sorts of sound, like I say, that I think is prima facie evidence of that could get Donald Trump committed. Honestly, just crazy. Also, this story by ProPublica of Ivanka and Junior, who are on the brink of facing fraud charges because of what they told potential buyers about their Soho project and the way in which this investigation went away, is a real problem. We'll also talk about the knives that must be out for Tillerson. And who might be holding those knives? We got a lot to talk about, and we will talk about it. We also got a lot of sound. We'll be right back. Don't forget, folks, this show depends on your membership for 96.3% of its revenue. Now, that's a lagging number. It could have gone up by 0.2 or down by 0.2 because we always, our accountants in the back room, they're always constantly churning away and developing spreadsheets for us. And then we have to learn how to open them each time when they email them to us. So that may be
accounting is so uptight.
The accounting is, they're breathing down our necks.
The real ball busters.
Don't forget, justcoffee.co-op, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Also, last night's TMBS, the Michael Brooks Show, some people call it, is available. You can check it out on iTunes or on YouTube. And who'd you have on last night?
Had on ContraPoints.
ContraPoints?
Yeah. Who's brilliant. Like, she does a YouTube channel dealing with, she actually knows what she's talking about when it comes to things like free speech, all of these like terms that have come to be a stand-in for like stupid people in our current environment. She actually trained in philosophy. She's, that was a really interesting conversation. And then Bree Joy Gray on as well on capitalism and cultural appropriation.
I've watched a bunch of ContraPoints videos. I like them.
Really smart. And also, like, actual, like, very high production value.
Yes.
Very interesting to watch. Like, artistic. She's making, like, almost short films. Yes. Like, it's not just commentary.
Yes. All right. And lastly, if you buy your crap from Amazon or Jet.com, do so through our link at MajorityReportKickback.com. Quick break. We'll be right back.
He says you're just a friend. says no.